It's been almost a year since Arkansas had its first case of COVID-19, and since then, a lot has changed. But what exactly have we learned, and what more can be done? We're taking a closer look at the pandemic's impacts this evening on Issues That Matter Still Here, the state of the pandemic in Arkansas. It's the latest in our series of panels presented by the Central Arkansas Library System, the League of Women Voters of Pulaski County, and KYR FM 89.1. Join me, Daniel Breen, and our panelists, Dr. Sheldon Ricklin with UAMS Northwest, State Representative Jack Ladyman, Loretta Alexander with Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families, and Dr. Mark Williams with the UAMS College of Public Health. This is Issues That Matter, Still Here, the State of the Pandemic in Arkansas. I'm Daniel Breen with KYR News. For the next hour, we'll examine the coronavirus pandemic, what the state's response has been, where we go from here, and why the virus has been more deadly for some groups of people. We posed those questions to our panelists in a forum recorded on Zoom on February 25th. Joining us are Loretta Alexander, Health Policy Director at Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families, Dr. Sheldon Ricklin with the UAMS Northwest Marshallese Clinic, Representative Jack Ladyman, Chair of the Arkansas House Public Health, Welfare, and Labor Committee, and Dr. Mark Williams, Dean of the UAMS Faye Bozeman College of Public Health. This show has been edited for time and clarity, but you can watch the full panel on KYR's Facebook page. We start our show tonight by asking about the state's response to the pandemic, emphasizing personal responsibility rather than punitive measures. So were the state's restrictions and the enforcement of them effective? Dr. Sheldon Ricklin answers first.
You know, for us Marshallese and Marshall Islanders or Pacific Islanders, personal responsibility for us is a bit different. And I think, you know, it has different layers. And, you know, I think everybody has their own different way of responding to it. It's really not the personal part. It's more the family. It's more the community responsibility part of it. Mm-hmm. You know, we come from an island, you know, it's always the village that's trying to take care of itself. So I think, you know, it was a good message, but, you know, I think it could have been tweaked a little bit better in ways of how the audience that you're trying to get to. Because I think how Marshallese hear it, how our Latinx, you know, community members or brothers and sisters hear it is a bit different in other minority groups as well. So for us, we had to kind of tweak it a little bit in terms of how do we get that across to our community across the state. And, you know, we took it beyond just personal responsibility. And we said it's the family responsibility. It's the community responsibility. And really, for us, we revere our elders. You know, it is what you need to do to take care of your family and protect your elders from not getting sick. Because that's part of our culture. Large gatherings for us are part of our culture. You know, that's how we get together. And that's part of our culture is the large gathering, whether it's in communities or in churches or whatever other events. So we had to kind of make adjustments according to that. What does that mean? You know, that it really is to protect your family, your community, to avoid those for now, because it will eventually come back to it at some point. We're all safe.
Thank you, Dr. Ricklin. Representative Ladyman?
Well, again, it's a very good question. And I agree with personal responsibility. And I think that's a good way to go. I think you have to communicate that. Some of the issues I think with that was, you know, if you think back to March, we didn't know what this was. We didn't know how to react. So Governor Hutchinson had a phased in approach with executive orders, and Secretary Smith and Romero, you know, they issued different executive orders at different times on the timeline from March until now. And those were in response to what was going on at the time. So whether personal responsibility was working or not working was really hard to judge because it was a changing environment. I think promoting personal responsibility through family and through community is a good idea. I don't know that we can say it worked or didn't work. But again, I look at the numbers here and in other states, and we looked at that regularly month by month, and we were doing as good as other states that were comparable to us. So I think personal responsibility approach did work somewhat.
Loretta Alexander, your opinions on the state's coronavirus restrictions and the emphasis on personal responsibility.
Well, I think the state would have done a much better job if there hadn't started to be pushback. Because if you think about it, from March until summer, people pretty much were following all the directives. And then way into the summer, the pushback got more and more. I think early, say about May or so, they started to push back on wanting to have big gatherings. And the other thing is, as long as Dr. Smith was there, people seemed to be more cooperative in terms of when he came onto that press conference every day, people appeared to be cooperating more with what he was saying. And then after he left, it's like pushback got a lot stronger in terms of not following the directives. And again, I also think, you talk about responsibility, you can't talk about personal responsibility without corporate responsibility and government responsibility. And for instance, I think that could have been a lot better with ensuring that people knew the rules that came out from the Federal Families First Act that was passed on in middle of March, saying that if you get sick or if your kid gets sick or if you need to stay at home, the laws require, there was a federal law that said these people have to be taken care of and you have to let them have that leave. Well, I never heard that talked about in the news. And the only reason I knew about it was because it's part of my job to know about it. And it made me wonder what else is happening with people that are having to go to work every day. And then a lot of people have the fear of, if I stay at home, I'll lose my job. So the responsibility personally and corporately and going, for the government, I think the prisons, at first it was not looked upon as a big deal. And then all of a sudden you had this explosion of cases in prisons. So, there are some to go around, enough blame to go around. But I think individually, people could have done better too.
Thank you. And Dr. Williams, your thoughts on the state's response?
Where I feel that the governmental response was lacking was in situations where people could not exercise personal responsibility. For example, within nursing homes, it's not it's a situation where there is less individual ability to choose than, let's say, if you're not in a nursing home. And the same with certain work environments. I agree completely with Ms. Alexander on that. Even after saying that, Arkansans, and we did some polling on this, were very compliant with the mask order once the mask order was issued. Prior to that, they were not necessarily, when it was completely thought of as personal responsibility, there was not as much compliance. But once the governor issued that mask mandate, upwards of 90% in certain sections of Arkansas were complying with the mask order, and in no section less than 80%. So there needs to be that reaffirmation that there is a civic responsibility that the government, in a sense, cannot abdicate. It has the police powers, which includes the right to protect the public's health. And that I feel that in certain circumstances, the government has not completely used to the best benefit of society.
The response to the pandemic, the coronavirus pandemic, which we are talking about right now, has been largely up to the states individually. Just curious of all of our panelists, what do you believe have been the repercussions of that? Should there have been a more centralized federal response or not? Loretta Alexander, if you don't mind taking that question, first of all.
Well, there was a lot of confusion early on with the federal government pitting the states against each other for obtaining personal protection equipment, not having enough personal protection equipment, and them trying to reserve enough for the healthcare industry, and so other people were told don't get the mask, don't we need this for the people that are taking care of other people. So that, again, that confusion I think caused a lot of distress among people. And then later on, when we had the mask order, when we started saying wear the mask, people reverted back to, thought about, okay, beforehand you were telling us don't wear the mask, don't buy the mask, leave them for other people. So it was all that confusion that was going on that carried over, I think. And a coordinated approach definitely would have been much, much more effective. You know, I've worked in public health, and I've seen every year you see how the flu shots are carried out. And, you know, and it's like the CDC gives direction to the public health department, and then they have a way of having those mass clinics. So I think if you had just one voice coming from the top, from the federal government, it would have worked so much better. And certainly if the politicians had stayed out of it and just let the scientists do the science and do the work, it would have definitely worked.
Representative Lademan, I'll turn it back to you. Should the response to the pandemic have been more centralized from the federal government?
Well, I think from the federal level, what we needed was guidance. And again, at the federal level, just like at the state and community level, they were learning as we went along. I think letting the states set up some of the controls was a good idea because our states are different. And we have different, you know, economies, different cultures, different groups. So I agree with the idea of letting the state do the controlling, but we needed good guidance at the federal level. And someone mentioned a while ago that when Dr. Smith was here, there was good compliance with the mask. As you all know, Dr. Smith was well-respected throughout the country. I was with him on some meetings in other states, and he was very good at his job. Not saying anything bad about Dr. Romero. I think he's done a good job as well. But I think Dr. Smith did have a lot of respect, and a lot of people respected his opinion and followed that. But I also think that as time went on, people got more reluctant, maybe. There was more pushback just because of the time, the length they were wearing the mask.
I'll go next to you, Dr. Mark Williams. Do you think the country should have had a centralized federal response to the pandemic, or should it have been on the onus on the states?
There should have indeed been a federal plan for dealing with the pandemic. And it was necessary for a couple reasons. I would say the first is there was the identification of the problem. In other words, what was the country facing? And it was well known within public health circles that this was a dangerous virus and that the nation was facing a dangerous situation. And the lack of clearly identifying the problem as dangerous and in effect life-threatening was an area in which the federal government could have played a key role. The second was, yes, the federal government to some degree was learning, but this is not the first time that the federal government has had experience with an epidemic. People from the CDC have worked in Africa and in Southeast Asia on other epidemics. And so there was knowledge, but that knowledge was never put into an effective plan. And the other mistake we made was we looked at it purely from a health perspective. We should have looked at it completely and totally how it would impact the nation. We should have treated it just as we would have treated a declaration of war on the United States. What would have it take? What have it taken to mobilize the country to address a threat? It wouldn't have just been health. It would have been economic. It would have been on the education system. It would have been completely through the entire social structure of the United States. There was no reason for anyone to have been hoarding toilet tissue, for example. We should have seen that there would have been consequences when people began to be afraid of the virus and think that they would be staying home. So I would say, yes, the federal government abdicated its role in terms of leading the response to of the pandemic. And we've seen the consequences, and there have been consequences.
Thank you, Dr. Williams. And Dr. Sheldon Ricklin, your thoughts on this question?
I think definitely, you know, we needed that federal guidance, okay, but it needed to be scientifically followed, right? There had to be science behind it, and that's where you go with it. I think, you know, definitely with that and what Dr. Williams said, you know, definitely described, but also within our different states, you know, like Representative Lademan mentioned, you know, we're all different at the same time, so we need to kind of tweak it to work within our different states, but definitely the changes in information and then the mass misinformation things, you know, just kind of made us, many of us, not trust what was coming up. And some of us were taking the stance of just kind of waiting and seeing what's going to happen. But definitely should have had more scientifically proven guidance from the federal level, and we tweak it according to the different states.
This is Issues That Matter. We'll be back after a short break. Welcome back to Issues That Matter, Still Here, the State of the Pandemic in Arkansas. I'm Daniel Breen with KYR News. Let's rejoin our conversation, recorded live on February 25th.
Let's move on now to what else we've learned about, or from the pandemic, rather, I should say, particularly about health disparities. There's been a lot of new information, at least new to most of us, uncovered because of the pandemic. So the question is, communities of color are more likely to become gravely ill or die due to COVID-19. What are some of the reasons for that, panelists, as far as you understand, and how can we best respond to this problem? And I'm going to start with you, Representative Ladyman. I'll give you the chance to go first on this question. Then I'll go to you, Dr. Ricklin, then to Loretta, and then to Dr. Williams.
You know, I think that gets back to economics within the communities and culture within the communities, maybe trust. I know trust can be an issue. You know, if you're in a, say the Marshallese as an example, you're not in your home country, even though, you know, the Marshallese have been here for many, many years, there's still a cultural difference. And I think that plays into it. And I think we could have done more to focus on those groups. We actually did at the state level, we did some focus on the Marshallese, allocated some funds to try to gain trust within the community. But I believe economics, I believe maybe some people in these communities, maybe they did not have the means to wear masks or to social distance. Maybe they were living in closer quarters, working in closer quarters. Some of them had specific jobs that maybe were required jobs, and they had to be in close proximity, but they had to work to feed their family. You know, one of the issues we had at the state level was the unemployment and the PPP program to keep small mom and pop businesses open. In many of those areas, small businesses, they're in close quarters. They had to do what they could to keep their businesses open. And I think that was true in all communities, but it might have been more evident in some of the minority communities. So I think we could have done a better job. I think it's an absolute fact that these communities were more affected than others, and we should have done a better job.
Thank you, Representative Ladyman. Dr. Ricklin, your thoughts?
No, I think definitely the data is there. I mean, unfortunately, speaking for the Marshallese Pacific Islander community, and I'm sure Dr. Williams would also agree with this, is, you know, we've been disproportionately affected. And it's sad, you know, because, you know, for us, you know, all of us, it's a close-knit community that we know everybody else. We're pretty much related to everybody else. When it comes with the trust issue, you know, we've got our, like other minority groups, we've got our history with mistrust with the U.S., and that dates back to the 1940s, 1950s, when they did the U.S. nuclear weapons testing in the islands, when they did Project 4.1, where they actually use us to study the effects of nuclear weapons. So, you know, you come from that background, and then you come here, you know, you look at the members of the community, of the Marshallese community in Northwest Arkansas and other places, were essential workers. You know, how do you tell them not to go to work when they need to work? Economics comes into play, as it was mentioned. You know, if you're gonna be sick in quarantine, you need, how do you be the breadwinner for the family when you cannot provide for the family? And of course, education comes into play as well. You know, it was so bad up in Northwest Arkansas, and you know, it was alluded to earlier that CDC came to the area back in the summer of June, July of last year to kind of look into the problem. And they found that, like our Latinx community, you know, the Marshallese Pacific Islander communities were disproportionately affected. We account for 2.4% of the region's population. But 19% of all the cases in adult cases in Northwest Arkansas at that time were Pacific Islanders, or basically primarily Marshallese. Our death rates were 372 per 100,000. That's compared to the overall general population of about 5 per 100,000. Our odds for death were quite high, you know, for the Pacific Islanders, for the Marshallese. We're even 25 times more than our brown Latinx community members as well. So it took all that for us to bring things that have always been there. We've always had these systematic issues in many things. And, you know, we talk about, you know, yeah, multi-generational households, because, you know, that's part of the culture. But at the same time, you know, how do you tell people in one household to quarantine or isolate without providing them with the resources that they need to make sure that they take care of themselves? So all these things, you know, kind of came into play. And it's very sad because, you know, it came to the point where we were going to funerals almost every week, well, every week, on every weekend. And most of the fresh graves you saw at the cemeteries were Marshallese folks who just passed away. You know, and I work with many of the inpatient hospitalists, doctors in the hospitals who manage the cases and trying to help them out with their Marshallese patients that were admitted. And, you know, they were struggling because they couldn't figure out how to get the message across that they're linguistically and culturally appropriate. So we developed, thanks to, you know, the state, that we got some of the grants that came to Northwest Arkansas, that, you know, we did a comprehensive response plan that basically collaborated many of the institutions that care for many of the minority groups in Northwest Arkansas. Not just that, but they actually engaged the community. They really engaged the community, looked at the local leadership and said, you know what? We know we're experts in certain things, but you're expert in your culture and your community. Tell us what you want us to do for you. How do we reach your community? You know, so we can provide that. And to this day, since that time, the numbers have dropped. As of February 1st, we went from 19% of the adult community cases to 6.3% in Northwest Arkansas. Same with the Latinx community. They dropped from 45% to now it's 28.7%. That just shows that, you know, the response that we've done here that incorporates multi-agencies and institutions, engage community members, that takes into account the culture and the language, providing contact tracing and language, as well as, you know, health navigation and all those different aspects that we talked about, seems to be working. And, you know, we're quite fortunate that, you know, we're seeing the lower numbers nowadays.
Thank you, Dr. Ricklin, for your answer and for your insight on the question. Loretta Alexander, your thoughts on COVID-19 disparities in communities of color, health outcome disparities, and how we can best respond to that.
There are many reasons that fall under social determinants of health. And, you know, studies show that medical care is just a percentage of overall health care. And, you know, there are a lot of social conditions that do impact how our health is and what the history of our health has been. Due to unfair discriminatory health and economic barriers, African Americans are more likely to have chronic illnesses that put people at greater risk for COVID-19. Some of those conditions are being overweight, hypertension, lung disease, diabetes, and heart disease. And in March, the CDC took the very first set of data that they got in March, and African-Americans were much higher than everybody else in the country from the very beginning with getting infected, getting hospitalized, and dying from COVID-19. And 28 to 50% of the patients had these conditions that I just mentioned. So also the long-term impact of racist policies like redlining, segregated communities, undermine access to safe neighborhoods, healthy foods, good schools, which again, if your health is already compromised and then something else comes in to attack it, you're much more likely to become a victim of it. The COVID-19 has just compounded all of these conditions that were already in place. Other factors include lack of clarity regarding whether testing and treatment was free. You know, let's say if I have insurance and I go to get tested and they know they can charge my insurance card, and I go back and tell my friend, well, yeah, my insurance got charged, and she doesn't have insurance, she's going to say, I don't have any insurance, I'm not going. Without, you know, there wasn't a large enough public awareness campaign to say, I don't care who you are, come and get tested, don't worry about having any money or not having any money. That just wasn't done well by the government. Lack of insurance, people that had jobs lost their jobs, and all of a sudden you don't have any insurance. And so, again, that contributed to you know, the lack of testing, or people getting sick before they even got tested. Most of the major hospitals are in certain communities, so a lot of people live a long way from the major hospitals in Arkansas. Dr. Ricklin mentioned multi-generational households. Our community, the African-American community, has a history of living in multi-generational households too, and taking care of their elders until, you know, they just can't be taken care of at home anymore. And statistically, African-Americans make up 30% of people in, 12% of workers in healthcare, employed workers, period. But they make up 30% of the licensed practical nurses in America. So if you look at just that statistic alone, and you've got all these people that work in healthcare, and then they're coming home to other folks and taking care of their families, it's a disproportionate share of folks in the health world and in the essential workers that are having to go out there and work and coming home and exposing their families to what they catch out there. The other thing is, a lot of African Americans don't have jobs where they can work from home. I've been fortunate to be able to sit here in this chair since last March and work, but a lot of people that I know, they have to get up and go out every day. They have small children, they have, you know, elders at home, you know, folks in the sandwich generation where you have children and you have a grandmother in the house. And even though, let's say, the kids are going out, they may not be getting sick, but they're bringing it back in to the elders. Dr. Ricklin has mentioned Pacific Islanders several times. They're more likely than any other racial group to have fewer financial resources. And again, they live in multi-generational housing. So there's just so many, many different reasons that this has happened. And what we can do about it is we can just recognize the fact that, you know, racism is a public health emergency, and work on fixing the infrastructure to make sure that there's equity across the board when it comes to healthcare.
Thank you very much, Ms. Alexander and Dr. Williams.
I would like to address that issue of perspective. I think the issue has been that we have not truly dealt with the pandemic from a public health perspective. We have largely dealt with it from a medical perspective. We have not taken the health issues and also the prevention practices to the communities. We've largely centered those in office situations. And I would say that's appropriate for certain parts of the community, but it's inappropriate for other parts of the community. And as both Dr. Ricklin and Ms. Alexander have said, we haven't asked well enough the communities, how do we, from a public health perspective, help you prevent the pandemic, as opposed to telling people how to go about preventing the pandemic. And as I've said all along and counseled, we should have taken prevention on the road a long time ago. We should have been in communities of color handing out masks. That should have been provided just as we would, let's say, food for people that were in need of food. We should have taken testing on the road and taken testing into the communities of color so that they didn't have to take off work, so that they didn't have to take off childcare and other necessary things that needed to be done, or transportation. We didn't think, except from the perspective of the usual medical model, 9 to 5, make an appointment, come in, we'll see you when we get to you. That doesn't work in an emergency. In an emergency, you do everything you possibly can to stem whatever it is you're confronting. And we simply weren't doing it. We were leaving tools laying around. I don't think we did it out of any intent. I just think we just didn't think it through well enough and asked the people who knew about it how to deal with communities, to help us deal with communities.
I'm going to move on again back to the policy aspect a little bit. On both the state and federal level, we've seen a lot of policy changes in direct response to the coronavirus pandemic, and in an attempt to provide relief, both economic and from a public health standpoint. Panelists, what policies do you think should continue beyond the pandemic? And what policy changes do you think that the state or the United States as a whole are still lacking? And I'm a little bit turned around on our order. I think I'm going to start with Dr. Williams. You're the lucky guy. I know you just went, so sorry about that.
I think I would phrase it as there are four things that we need to do. The first off is we need to have a plan on how we go about dealing with similar situations in the future. That plan should address how do we communicate about a pandemic with the public. How do we get out in front of and fill the media and airwaves so that there isn't a void? Because we know if there's a vacuum of information, people will fill it, and that will be filled with misinformation. The second thing we need to do is we need to assess how do we address the entirety, not just from a health perspective, but also from an economic perspective, on how we react to a pandemic. What industries or what manufacturing do we need to have available so that we can respond? And what policies need to be in place so that the government can direct those responses? The fourth is we need more public health and a better public health workforce. And we don't need that necessarily in the sense of full-time public health workers. But we need a public health force that we can mobilize in the time of an emergency. For example, right now, one of the best ways that we could deal with this pandemic is to immunize as quickly as we possibly can. We don't need to rely on physicians and nurses simply to do that. You don't need a degree to put a needle in someone's arm. We could train a public health reserve that could do that and be mobilized in the time of an emergency, just like we would with the National Guard. And so there are other things that I think we could learn from an assessment of how we've dealt with the pandemic. And I think we could come up with some good policies and some good plans for the future.
Thank you very much, Dr. Williams. Dr. Ricklin, your thoughts?
I think for us to go back to normal, it's got to be a new normal. Whatever we had before didn't work. It never works. And you know, we've as an advocate for Pacific Islanders and Marshallese in different aspects, whether it's with healthcare or public health, and public health is very important. I mean, you have great public health, then you don't have to strain your healthcare structure. You know, it's prevention. I mean, we got to work on that aspect there. But before you can do that, you definitely need to have that access for the patients. They got to have access to healthcare. They got to be able to come and get tested and see the doctors without the lack of insurance or with all those big bills that they're going to be worried about. They need to be educated about it. But, you know, the whole community also needs to be educated about it as well. You know, I think that's what we saw, that many of the things that we had been working for many years in trying to get our people to have access were just getting more magnified. You know, they finally came to the forefront. You know, culturally and linguistically appropriate services, whether it's in clinics, in hospitals, whether it's in the education system, but you need to have that. We all need to get out of our silos. You know, we need to basically build those bridges between everybody else. I think there's still the politics of us thinking that we know best, we're the experts, we'll tell you what you need to know. But we need to reverse that. We need to go to the community and ask them what do they need, because they're the experts in what they need and what do they want. And, you know, I think, you know, we've always been working on that and trying to do that. You know, the data speaks for itself. You see the high disproportionate numbers affecting the minority communities. In the beginning, they were always talking about, you know, go get tested, let's get all you tested, because, you know, the numbers are there. But now with the vaccination part, that should all, the data should also reflect how you address the vaccination plan. Many, we know that our Pacific Islander community disproportionately high, but it's, we're not listed in there in terms of minority groups or any other minority groups, basically, in terms of how do you get the vaccine to them fast. And what we're doing at UMS Northwest campus is, you know, we're, as we're testing people, we're also asking them, we're doing our own testing and questionnaire and survey and saying, you know, when it comes to the vaccination part, how do we reach you? How do we get to you? How do we explain things to you? And you got to have those community leaders and members with faces that look like them, speaking with them and telling them exactly why it is safe that they should do this. And that there's people that actually care for them, and you know, you should build a trust, that rapport, those bridges between all the different groups.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ricklin. Representative Lademan, your thoughts on policy changes related to the coronavirus pandemic?
With this pandemic, and again, working in the government is a whole lot different than working in private business. But I felt like we were writing the plan as we were going through the pandemic, and we're still writing the plan. And we, that should not be the case. We should have a plan at the state level and at the national level. Each state should have a plan. You know, we have emergency response plans in each county in the state for things like here in Jonesboro for earthquakes, because we're on the New Madrid Fault or close to it, tornadoes. You know, we have, it doesn't cover pandemics. It needs to. And we need to have something at the state level. And that could be done now that we've learned what we've learned during this pandemic. And I hope going forward, that's something that we do through Adam, our emergency response team at the state level. And I've talked to the folks there at Adam about maybe trying to do that. I know the governor's thinking about that. The second thing is, and this was mentioned a couple of times, access in rural areas. And that's a big problem in Arkansas. And we found that out during the pandemic. And one of the things y'all may know, but we tried multiple times to pass telemedicine laws in previous sessions. I'm in my fourth session now. I know in the two prior sessions, we tried to pass telemedicine, and we did pass portions of that. But when the pandemic hit, that was wide open. We established relationships with other states around us. We opened up the telemedicine to where you didn't have to see a doctor at the beginning. You could call a doctor on your telephone because it's an emergency. As someone said, it's a war, and it should be a war. We should have had a war room. We should have been fighting this like a war. So we relaxed a lot of those things so that you could call a doctor on your telephone and talk to them about, hey, you know, these are my symptoms. What do I need to do? Where do I get tested? And that sort of thing. And the doctor, even if it was a doctor you didn't have contact with, they could get your medical records without the person traveling 100 miles to go to Little Rock or Fort Smith or Jonesboro or Fayetteville. So we did a lot of those things. We've got multiple bills running through the session right now that we're in session, making those things that we did during the pandemic code. So putting them into law. Telemedicine is the one that comes to mind. The other thing, and I think someone mentioned this, that, you know, a lot of people can put a shot in an arm. They don't have to be doctors, full-fledged trained doctors. So what we're doing, and this is a difficult thing to do because, you know, the medical community, the fully trained people, the doctors, they want the best quality of medical care that can be provided in every instance that they're treating someone. And I understand that. I'm a professional in an engineering, and I feel the same way about my profession. But sometimes you can't get the perfect. And what's available is better than nothing. And you can have someone at a lower trained level give the vaccinations. The pharmacists are now giving vaccinations. We relaxed a lot of things, and we're probably going to do more of that. We've got multiple bills that deal with our nurse practitioners, CRNAs, athletic trainers, physical therapists who are lesser trained than PhDs, but they can do multiple things. Now, the problem with that is it's really changing the culture in the medical field. But we have to take the good. We cannot wait for the perfect.
And Laird Alexander, your thoughts on policy changes?
Speaking of vaccines, the planning definitely needs to include making sure that those families keep getting those vaccines and things like that. Because, you know, as kids are growing, they don't stop growing when things happen. So we're looking at the pediatric side of things. It's a lot of families that didn't get the developmental assessments. They didn't get the vaccines. I mean, large percentage didn't get vaccines between March and August or whatever. And so we need to really include every aspect of the community when we're doing that. And you know, and we already have a public health system in place. We've got 75 counties, and the last time I looked, we had almost 85 public health facilities around the state. So we have a portion of an infrastructure there. And even though the doctor's offices were shut down, you know, we still need to keep in mind how to serve everybody as we go forward. And, you know, and everybody has mentioned planning. I agree 200%. I actually was a nursing home administrator, and you want to talk about an emergency plan. You got to know if something happens, who's in a wheelchair, who has to be moved by an ambulance, who has to be moved, you know, every aspect of that building, and ultimately how to shelter in place. If you got to keep all your staff there for how long it takes, you got to know what it takes. So again, we don't need to start from scratch with any of this planning. It's there. We just need to pull it together and have people from every aspect of professional world come together and make a state plan. We also need to have some kind of way, I don't know if you would call it a drill or whatever, but at the community level, we need to have some kind of way to make sure that people are aware of those plans and how to carry them out, not just have a plan in the book and it be sitting somewhere in Little Rock. And the people that run, say, the emergency system know how to do it, but people at the local community don't know. We got to have it out there across the state.
You're listening to Issues That Matter Still Here, the State of the Pandemic in Arkansas, a forum brought to you by the Central Arkansas Library System, the League of Women Voters of Pulaski County, and KUYR FM 89.1. We'll be back in a moment. This is Issues That Matter Still Here, the State of the Pandemic in Arkansas. I'm Daniel Brain. We're speaking with our panelists, Loretta Alexander with Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families, Dr. Sheldon Rickland with the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences, Dr. Mark Williams with the UAMS College of Public Health, and State Representative Jack Ladyman.
I want to talk about vaccination. Of course, vaccination is what is on everyone's mind right now, but it has been hampered certainly by logistics as well as misinformation and vaccine hesitancy, of course. So just curious, what are some of the things that the state, the country, us as individuals, what can we do to combat those issues? And I will start with you, Dr. Rickland.
I think, you know, over the last year, we've learned quite a bit. You know, we know what's worked and what has not worked. And what we've been doing here, you know, as we've been learning through the months with this pandemic, with the testing and prevention and masking and all these things, we've also at the same time trying to kind of figure out how do we get the vaccines to those who need it. And we need to go to the communities. And that's what we've been doing with our Marshallese community here. It's basically finding places that they know that they're safe. They know and they trust the people who's going to be there, that we can go to them. So that, for example, the Marshall Islands Consular Office, you know, we've had vaccine events there where people come there and we vaccinate them. And, you know, to Representative Ladyman's, you know, a point as well, you know, and we've utilized, and kudos to the pharmacists, you know, they've stepped up a lot, you know, so we've been able to get the vaccine to our patients or community members through them. But we've also utilized many of our professional students as well. You know, many of the vaccine clinics, they utilize the students who are supervised by their faculty members as they're giving the vaccines. We've also brought in Marshallese healthcare navigators to be there to show face that they're there so they can at least get vaccinated. We've been trying to kind of educate them and answering their questions. what is their concern? What is it that they do? They trust the vaccine? Do they not trust the vaccine? How can we educate them about these vaccines? And it always has come back to the culture. It always comes back to the community and the family. You know, you may not want to get the vaccine, but if you know that you're going to get the vaccine to protect your family, then you do it. And that's the Marshallese way. That's the Pacific Islander way. You put somebody else's health first before yours. So if you need to do something for you so you can serve your families and keep them safe, the elders at home to be safe, then you do that. So we try to focus on vaccine acceptance and making it more a positive thing for them to kind of understand. And thankfully, so far, from what I can see with our many vaccine clinics we've done, there's been a lot of acceptance to that. And we continue kind of build on that and try to educate others. But, you know, they're the experts in what they need. So we just got to address their needs and the concerns or the challenges.
Thank you, Dr. Ricklin. Representative Ladyman.
A couple of things. The pharmacists, as Dr. Ricklin said, have really stepped up. But the local pharmacies, the mom and pop pharmacies is what I like to call them, have done a much better job of getting the vaccines out there. As y'all probably know, CVS and Walgreens were given the task of vaccinating the nursing homes and the long-term care facilities, human development centers. My oldest son was in a human development center at the beginning of the pandemic. He's not there now, but those were very fragile communities and they needed the vaccine as quickly as possible. And at the federal level, they thought, well, that's the best way to do that because these companies are throughout the country and they have large operations and they can get that done quicker than the moms and pops. It's more coordinated. Well, that wasn't really true. If y'all ever worked in the corporate world, you do what corporate says. And it's harder to deal with large corporations than it is with mom and pop because there's a lot of red tape. So that didn't work with CVS and Walgreens. And too many vaccines were sent to those businesses. So at one point, they only had distributed 16% of the vaccines that they had, which was terrible. And the mom and pops were closer to 50%. And they were only close to 50% because they were holding back 50% for the second shots, right? So they were doing an excellent job. The other thing, and it's been mentioned, is to raise awareness of the benefits of the vaccine. And people are afraid to take the vaccine because of all the things that are out there. And this is not just in the minority communities. You know, I have a brother and two sisters. My youngest sister had the virus. My older brother took the vaccine. My other sister won't take it because she has allergies. So somehow we've got to educate, you know, people on the benefits of it and what reactions they might have. And maybe we can do that through schools. Maybe we can have at the community center vaccinations once we get a supply line going. So once we get more vaccines in the pipeline, we can have these public vaccination centers and maybe have folks there that can help with the education of that.
Thank you, Representative Ladyman. Loretta Alexander, I'll go to you next.
I think that one of the things that I saw early on was there was a lot of distrust, and rightfully so in certain communities, like Dr. Ricklin said. You know, in the African-American community, we have the Tuskegee Institute issue, and then we have just a systemic racism that occurs even now where they believe that, you know, certain people have higher thresholds for pain and things like that. So you have a lot to fight through to get people to hear what you're going to say. And I have to, before this closure, I held a forum back in September, and I had the same feeling that these vaccines were developed too quickly, because I've studied epidemiology more than once. You know, Dr. Williams, actually my last class was there at the College of Public Health. So I, you know, and I enjoy it. So I knew the stages that you go through, and you know, stage 1, 2, 3, and 4. So how are they going to do that all at this quickly? And then Dr. Gloria Richard Davis, who is the chair of the COVID Equity Response Team, she said, well, you know, the head of all the 4 African-American medical schools in the country are participating directly in these studies. So that kind of relieved me. And then, you know, she went on to say that one of them was an infectious disease expert. So, and then the idea that, okay, here's how they do it. They have all the money that they need to do it. They don't have to wait to get the next grant and the next grant. So it made sense once all of those things were dispelled, all of my reservations were dispelled. And so I've got information from the Annals of Internal Medicine that says you've got to listen to people. You got to listen to people's concerns and give them answers to get rid of those, to answer their concerns. Here's why this has happened is like this. Here's how it can happen differently. And here's what will happen if not, what can happen, and what's the percentage of what will happen worse if it does, if you don't get vaccinated, you know. And in my mind, I'm thinking getting COVID would be a lot worse than getting vaccinated. I mean, basic bottom line. So, and then as Dr. Ricklin has said over and over, you have to have the trust in the community, and trust is earned. It's not given. You've got to find people that people in the community trust. You've got to take away the misinformation. There's a lot, you know, once something is going on Facebook, it becomes the gospel. And people throw the Bible away and they just listen to that as the gospel. So again, we've got to figure out, we've got to get through that misinformation and get to people individually to say, okay, here's what really is going on, and here's what the science is, and this many people have already taken. And I think another thing is would be just simply the people that are taking it in the community, because I have a lot of friends that are old enough to have taken it before me. I haven't taken it yet. And I'm watching and waiting to hear from them what their experiences are. And if they share with other people, I think the more people you share with, you know, in general, it makes it easier. Mr. Ladyman, obviously your sister doesn't believe you, but in general, you know, it kind of goes that way. You know, people you trust. And you trust on more than one thing. But if you don't know anybody you trust that's telling you anything, or anybody that looks like you that's telling you, or you know, from that perspective, I think one thing that could happen better is there could be some public service announcements on, you know, or some news reports to say if you know, some African-American physicians are sitting there saying, listen to me, you know, somebody that a lot of folks know. That have a lot of patients that they know that trust them. So you can't just kind of have one line in the news or have it sort of in over here in the corner. You've got to have the people that folks trust giving them the information.
And Dr. Mark Williams, take us home.
There has been a paucity of what I would call good advertisement about the vaccines and about prevention of spreading the virus. And we have not taken advantage of the same media that those people who are proposing what I would say disinformation about the virus and about the vaccines. In other words, every message that's on YouTube that's negative about the vaccines should encounter four messages that are positive. And we have the capability of doing that. The other mistake we've made is we've relied solely on people who do not necessarily know how to communicate with different communities to talk about vaccines and about preventing the spread of the virus. We need more than Dr. Fauci, as interesting, as an important a character as he is. We need others. For example, I'm going to take a slightly different direction. Where are the Baptist ministers in this fight? They should be, if nothing else, making YouTube videos, preaching to their congregations that the vaccines are important. And I would then carry that on through the rest of the communities. Those people that talk to their communities in their language should be making videos, should be making YouTube statements, should be having Facebook statements on their own home pages. And so I think this is a situation where, again, we're in a war. You don't let someone else deliver the message for you. You deliver the message yourself. And we need to deliver the truth, and we need to do it in a way that's incredibly important. And I'll go back to I've had experience working on a different pandemic in Tanzania. And one thing that I was incredibly impressed with the Tanzanian government about is they did billboards all across Dar es Salaam about how to prevent HIV transmission. Where are the billboards here? How many have you seen in Little Rock? How many have you seen on the interstates? So again, I want to say, I'm just so impressed with the panel that their responses have been so thoughtful. And there is a lot we can do, and there's a lot we need to do.
That was Dr. Mark Williams, joined by Loretta Alexander, Dr. Sheldon Rickland, and Representative Jack Ladyman. You've been listening to Issues That Matter Still Here, The State of the Pandemic in Arkansas, our latest panel discussion presented by the Central Arkansas Library System, the League of Women Voters of Pulaski County, and KYR FM 89.1. You can find the full unedited conversation on KYR's Facebook page. And be sure to tune in to our next forum, The Need to Read, on April 22nd at 6:30 p.m. Register at cals.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Daniel Breen, and this is Issues That Matter.